Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Reputation matters now more than ever. Public opinion in the wake of the financial meltdown has revealed the public's abiding mistrust of corporations and the executives who run them. Scrutiny from the internet and 24-hour cable TV offers companies no place to hide, so they must proactively seek the confidence of their shareholders and the public. Peter Feierstein offers 7 strategies for reputation leadership in his book, The Crisis of Character. Using real-life examples, Crisis of Character presents concrete ways executives can shape the internal corporate culture to support their business interests. Peter Feierstein is a consultant specializing in reputation risk management in both public and financial arenas. Peter, welcome to Edgewise.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's go right to the heart of the matter. Why does reputation matter more than it ever did before?
Any individual corporation is more subject to the social themes around it than ever before. Until a number of years ago, we had a prevailing model of the corporation that could be described as a fortress corporation. Companies pretty much were able to control their own universes. They could do what they thought was best for their productivity and for their shareholders. Things changed radically a number of years ago. They changed with the advent of the revolution in information technology and with the growing public consciousness that corporations affected the environment. They had profound impacts on how communities lived, both at home and everywhere in the world where they conducted their operations. The internet and the social consciousness that arose gave them a very different environment in which to do their business. People became aware of their impact, and because of the internet, anybody in the world with a connected computer was able to observe and scrutinize the activities of any given corporation. Not only that, but to broadcast globally their opinions, and if they wished to be part of an activist group to initiate concerted action against the corporation. And that was before the financial meltdown, in which the public lost a great deal of confidence it had had in the conduct of corporations. Today, the public feels very much victimized by the conduct of the financial world and corporations in general. They've seen their wealth depleted, and they believe it is for reasons that have nothing to do with their own conduct. A corporation must speak into this changed atmosphere today. Its reputation is more crucial than ever. There are certainly ways of making this change so they can use this new environment to become even more innovative and competitive. But the model of their own behavior has got to change accordingly.
Peter, the subtitle of the book is Building Corporate Reputation in the Age of Skepticism. And clearly the recession has raised skepticism and distrust. But skepticism exists not only in the public, but within companies about their own firm. Now, why is that?
If you're referring to employees, requirements of their own employer that they cohere to the fundamental values as they prevail in the world today, I think you've hit upon one of the most important themes that are going on in corporations. There is an enormous opportunity that companies have in the diversity of their workforces, the diversity of point of view. One tremendous dynamic affecting corporations today is their consumers all over the world are looking very different than the consumers 25 years ago. They're in all countries, all cultures. They adhere to all kinds of religions. This is the very definition of the word diversity. At the same time, their workforces are beginning to mirror their consumers as the workforces of companies begin also to be of all different backgrounds and national identities and so on. Unfortunately, the managements of many, particularly U.S. corporations, look somewhat like they did 25 years ago. And one thing company managements ought to be asking themselves is, what part of the whole person that comes in the door of our headquarters or our facilities in the morning can they bring in that would benefit the corporation? And how much is left outside because of their perception of our demands on them, the disciplines we impose on them? And the question is, are we benefiting from what our people have to offer? Companies need to look at their ability to benefit from the inherent diversity of point of view they have within their walls.
So what does a strong reputation look like?
One way you know that you have a strong reputation is when something goes wrong, you get the benefit of the doubt. The public, and particularly the press, believe ahead of time that you're a good company and are willing to listen to your story before making judgments. If you have a chemical spill or somebody is hurt in your factory, do people immediately assume it is evidence of business as usual at your company, or is it perceived as an exception? The CEO prepares for crisis every day of his or her career. And the reputation you build is that reputation which will come back to you when something goes wrong. That's when you find out really how good you've been in building it day by day and year by year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You offer 7 strategies for reputation leadership. Could you go deeper on these for us?
Sure. The first thing a company has to do is figure out who it is and establish core values. Who a company is in its own definition of itself has to be something that has arisen from its own internal conversations. Management doesn't decide this. It's a value system the workforce has participated in developing and can be held responsible for. Strategy 2, the company has to be able to see itself as others see it. It has to find ways of talking to its constituencies, either directly or through intermediaries, preferably both. It has to take a proactive approach to understanding how others see it. This is a continuous process. This is not something you do once and then you do again some other time. It has to take place at all times. From this gathering of intelligence on your constituents' viewpoints, you make what is called a stakeholder map that enables the company to see who its critics are, who its supporters are, but also what themes are shared by various groups, critics and supporters. This kind of intelligence is critical in structuring communications. You've got to understand those who are listening to you.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Perhaps the most important strategy is build your reputation from the inside out. Reputation comes out of how the company is run every hour of every day. You cannot solve problems by communication strategy alone. You cannot develop a reputation by communicating brands or empty slogans. Your reputation is built in the way that every person associated with the company interacts with customers and other stakeholders every day. To quote the poet William Blake, you can see the universe in a grain of sand. You can pretty much tell the culture in the C-suite of the corporate headquarters by talking to anybody, anywhere in an organization. If you ask the guy who drives a forklift in a distant factory how he feels about his job, what the rules are, what his attitudes towards his own foreman are, you can tell pretty much what is going on in headquarters 1,000 miles away. You have to tell your corporate story, engagement with those who are listening to you in a way that you become vulnerable is critical. Communication is a two-way exercise.
Right. That's definitely true.
You have as well to prepare for crisis. The CEO saves the company every day by the way he or she behaves and by the way he or she insists that the company behave. Lastly, there always has to be an extreme and minute level of accountability. So the board has to be a board that has strong independent elements. The movement towards independent board members and corporate governance is strong and getting stronger every day. And the dialogue between management and the board has to be fully transparent to both sides. Those are the 7 strategies of crisis of character.
Okay, now let's go back to see yourself through stakeholders' eyes. Sometimes management is blinded. They don't really look clearly at how their company is perceived. What would you advise regarding this?
There's a term that I have invented, the value paradox, which describes the relationship between a company management, the management that lives every day trying to build value inside of its company and understands the company and the industry and the business certainly better than anybody else, on one side and the institutional investors on the other side, who every day by their own actions in the market decide what the company is worth by deciding how much they're going to pay for the stock. This relationship between these two groups is usually laced with a considerable amount of dissonance. The managers feel in a way victimized by the fact that the investors, who are never inside the company except on that rare occasion every year when they might be invited, determine not only the value of the company, but not incidentally, the personal wealth of the managers who are running the company. What you hear from them is these people have never run a company for a day in their life. They misunderstand our technology, our marketing, and so on, but we're subject to them. The institutional investors basically believe that if they are lacking in knowledge about the company, it's because the company hasn't told them. Because the managers live inside the company, they think they know where the value lies. And that story is generally the story that they've been sitting around the conference table for years telling each other. The investors often have a very different idea of how to build value. It is up to the management to resolve these difficulties. The first thing management has to do is understand what drives the investors' thinking.
So what can they do?
There are all kinds of techniques for doing this. There are various kinds of perception studies. There are surveys. There are simple person-to-person conversations that can take place. But management, first of all, has to understand that these things are possible to do because they often lie outside the comfort zone of classically trained managers. So this is how companies can undertake the essential task of understanding how their stakeholders and their investors feel for a simple matter of the manager's own survival.
Okay. Tell your corporate story. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. One thing the company has to do is understand where the deficits are in investors' understanding of the company. These things are identifiable, and miraculously often, they are resolvable, but it has a great deal to do with management understanding what the stakeholders need to hear in terms of legitimate information and background, rather than the story they have fallen in love with telling them. They may not have to change the company an iota in order to improve the way their investors see the company, but they have to communicate according to what the investors need to know, and most particularly, the areas on which the investors place value. The company can undertake an argument with its investors where the company says, well, we think this is most important in terms of valuing the company, and the investors can say, we think something else is more important. One can be emphasizing margins, the other can be emphasizing cash flow. It's up to the company to understand how they think, because the investors can sell the stock. The managers can't sell themselves.
Exactly. Peter, you've mentioned that the CEO saves the company every day. What happens when a real crisis comes and you have to act?
One way is by implementing an utterly comprehensive crisis plan that you hope never to use, but is there every moment and is continually updated. It consists of a structure of whose job is to understand what happened, whose job is to communicate, who the key people to call are, and so on. That is all a matter of tactics. But the most important thing to understand with regard to crisis is you have to tell the whole story, and you have to tell it immediately. It may not be pretty, but many, many more companies have gone down by denying what has happened or by being misleading than they have simply saying, we made a big mistake. Here's what we did. Here is how we plan to correct it. And here's who's responsible.
Right.
There's something that crisis advisors talk about called the golden hour. If you've had a fatality, a toxic spill, an explosion, there's a golden hour when the company is able to control the story. Before the press, before regulators, before the police, if it's something that would involve the police, have been able to develop a narrative, the company has the first chance to do that. It's up to them to create a situation where they have begun to advance the public's understanding of what actually happened, rather than their communications becoming the story later on.
Very interesting. Can you give us some examples?
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
We all remember the Exxon Valdez.
Sure.
Exxon has taken tremendous hits from that. some of which they deserved, some of which they did not. Their big mistake was not lying about it, but simply not undertaking the gesture of the CEO flying to Prince William Sound in Alaska. For the last 20 years, they've been held responsible for not caring, whereas in fact, they acted quickly, but they didn't let people know it. Companies have lost their independence in terms of whether you keep the company or not, out of dissembling responses to crises where a good response would have saved the company. Perrier is one. Terribly mishandled an occasion when some benzene was found in its water. Their consumers never came back during those years. Their stock never came back. They were sold to Nestle. Same thing happened with Bausch & Lomb. There was a contact lens solution that irritated some people's eyes. Then they withdrew the product in Asia, but they didn't withdraw the same product in other parts of the world. And eventually, the loss of support when that came out led to their own sale.
Right. Now let's go to the governance imperative, which is something that the board of directors must focus on.
The board of directors is responsible for the conduct of senior management, including the CEO. It's certainly become evident in recent years that there has often been too close a relationship between the CEO and the board, particularly when the CEO is the chairman of the board.
Right.
And selects the members of the board.
Uh-huh. Sure.
Boards and board members who know that they can be held liable are finding the need to hold themselves accountable for what happens within the company.
Peter, you've created some original terms and used them throughout the book. Now, one of them was communications of convergence. Can you talk about that?
It has to do with a dynamic almost every company faces at one point or another, where it has critics. Often they are legitimate activist groups that may be critical of the product or the kind of product that the company produces. The communications of convergence is a strategy for engaging one's opponents. Let's say you are the CEO of a company and there is an activist NGO that is critical and is calling press conferences, may even have a demonstration or two against your company. What do you do? Do you hold an interview minimizing them and calling them fringe elements, thinking they'll go away? Or one other thing you might do is call up the head of that NGO. That's a revolutionary act at times in corporate life. And let's say you propose to sit down privately and just chat. Let's say you do that once and say, how about doing this again in a couple of months? It really doesn't matter that much what gets said. Because if you do it on an ongoing basis, privately, there is an understanding that arises, and it has a couple of different components. One component is both sides have now got an investment in having this conversation. Another is the conversation has begun to evolve in certain terms that allow the two sides to understand each other. The company certainly is not pushing a point of view. A company is engaging, and by engaging becomes vulnerable as well to the other side. There's no way to have such a conversation otherwise. But what eventually happens is the company finds that to some extent, the other side begins using the terms they have developed in this conversation in dealing with their own constituencies and in dealing with their own press and so on, to the point that the company realizes this is a way that it has influenced the terms the public uses to discuss its own affairs, at least. So it is therefore communications of convergence because both sides then begin using the same language. Generally, the tenor of opposition resolves into a dialogue that has accommodations on both sides. But it takes a real creative effort on the part of the corporate manager to initiate this. The rewards can be immense.
Peter, do you have any concluding thoughts you want to leave our audience with?
There's a concept in the book that encapsulates all the things it's trying to say to any manager who happens to be reading the book. Mm-hmm. The public is looking for an end to something I've called the corporate exception, the belief that grew over many years in companies that a different set of standards of conduct existed inside corporations than outside. In fact, I argue in the book that people who did things in companies that turned out to be highly ill-advisable, did things they would never do, acted in a way that they would never act in their own personal lives. And what the world is really looking for is an end to that corporate exception, a one-size-fits-all ethics. And I think if corporate managers understand that, things will go much more smoothly and in a much more productive way for the corporations.
We've been speaking to author Peter Feierstein. His book is entitled Crisis of Character, Building Corporate Reputation in the Age of Skepticism. Peter, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
With only an internet connection and a browser, you can tap into AMA's world-class training. The American Management Association is bringing live instructor-led training right to your desktop. AMA's new virtual seminar offering features a live virtual format that is highly interactive and very user-friendly. It's taught by the same expert, world-class faculty that run our classroom sessions, and the high-quality content has been specially engineered to run in an online format. You get real-time online interaction with your course leader and your fellow attendees. You will receive a USB headset so that you can not only listen but talk to your classmates and your instructor. So take advantage of these offerings, enhance your career journey by building your skills, and you don't have to take any time away from the office. For more information about AMA's virtual seminar offering, visit our website at www.amanet.org. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.